Yeah, it's the 20th. It was Wednesday. And, yeah, I'm blown away that I did not realize that the last 2 years. Happy belated birthday to you. We shared same day. That's amazing. We went out. We had a good Gigi and I had a good time. Went out and had a good dinner. So I hope your birthday went well.
It was a, for a midweek thing, it was really nice. And we'll probably get another dinner in, probably with the Siakas tomorrow. Downstate, so I'm not trying to make the 60. I don't know. I'm not a big. It's a milestone. So I guess I guess it is. Happy for you guys, and wanted to talk to you on Wednesday because Ed had joined us on Tuesday previewing the Pick Five. I talked about it with Marty a little bit, and. We did get some handicapping from Dale Romans, very kind of surreptitious handicapping, but he was actually pretty valuable because he basically told everybody that Marty McGee's brother's horse, Paul McGee's horse, was going to win past the plate. How did you do with the pick five?
Well, I wish I had listened to that interview because past the plate was a horse that I tried to beat in that turf race. It was like four or five deep and literally. Wasn't close at all. So I used the 12-1 winner because that horse had run well at 7 furlongs, had like two or three wins at the distance, and had, the other winners were all pretty short price. So went 4-5 though.
Yeah, it's funny when you rehash these. It's funny because there's always somebody who sniffed out a horse that you didn't, that either you didn't, not necessarily didn't like, but even, just in deep races, that fourth leg was, was really tricky. And in one version, I had 3 A's, 3 B's, and 2 C's. And it was in the C's that I had home base. But then when I built the ticket and punched it, I actually had trimmed back and I went 3 A's and 3 C's, the former B's. And I understand Scott Shapiro loved home base. And so, I mean, it's just a, it's so difficult when you're trying to balance the opinion and then the ticket building in these sequences. And I put a $72 ticket together and the A ticket was 24, the all A's, for more of a budget play. And I it's funny, I got three legs in and I thought I'm in good shape here. I didn't even think of, how about that horse that finished second to home base? That was what? That was 60-1.
Yeah. Like 50-1, was an outside post, ran his eyeballs out. I think it was 11, wasn't it? I forget his name though.
Was it Root? Not Rube. Was it Rubus? It was.
Yeah, Rubus. That was it.
It was Rubus, I think.
And then the Peter Miller horse that was really, I thought, sort of overbet, ran third, and I tried to beat him. So that was like at least one good opinion I had. But
all right, well, let's get some good opinions going into the weekend. Marty was with us earlier, and we just sort of, touched on the fields. So maybe just, jump around, and if you got some stuff today and anything that you're looking at for weekend plays.
Sure. I'll start. I can start today. I haven't looked at it too closely, but I did look at this race number 8. They're off the turf today, so I don't think they're going to get that much rain overnight. I'd be surprised if they didn't try to run on the grass tomorrow. But in race number 8 today, a mile and a 16th, maiden special weight for 2-year-old fillies, number 11, Miss Important. Didn't show much in her first two starts, one on the turf, one sprint in Keeneland. But stretched out to a one-turn mile last time. I thought ran a really good third, showed improved speed. Comes back in this spot for Kenny McPeak with a bullet work at Keeneland in preparation, Brian Hernandez. And, Kenny McPeak won like about one of his first like 25 starts. He got off the real cold start to the meet, and the spring meet was similar. And he finished that spring meet on fire in June And that barn is turning it around as well. I look for, you know, his horses to run well, because he had that real nice filly on Saturday, that first time starter by Daredevil, that 2-year-old filly that won by like 5 lengths in the finale. And then he had Crypto Cash yesterday at 11-1. So his bet barn's starting to heat up. I thought the race was really between Miss Important and Lady McKenzie, who ran second last time in the same race. And I'm going to give the edge to the 11.
Nice.
And then turning to Saturday, I'll go over a couple races. Some horses I thought were interesting, had good speed in the latter half of the card tomorrow at Churchill. Race number 7 is a maiden special weight race. And obviously, in that race, the 11 horse Gold Street's the one to beat. It's not the most imposing field here. McPeak has a horse, Mayberry Deputy, I gave a little bit of a look to as well, with Upper Rue. But I do think that this Noble Empire is a little intriguing. Number 2, 10-1 on the morning line for Dwayne Lucas, cutting back to 6 furlongs. I know this colt's by Empire Maker, but out of an Indian Charlie mare, all this speed in the female family. First time out at Saratoga, he made the lead that day at 34-1, wound up weakening to be beat about 2 lengths in third. It wasn't the fastest race, but the runner-up came back. Mark Henning came back and broke his maiden next time out at Belmont. So it was a pretty solid field. In his next two starts at Churchill Downs, Noble Empire didn't make the lead in either one. Did not make the lead at all in the next race. And last time he was really just chasing it from an outside post. I think with Martin Garcia aboard, he has a chance in this field to sprint clear early, especially if the track's favoring speed tomorrow. Got a little bit of a wire-to-wire look at 10-1 on the morning line.
Like it. Nice.
And then in race number 8, which is a $10,000 claimer, there's some, it's a big field. Maker has this horse Zipto for Zayac Stables, dropping from 20 to 10 off a win. Going to be the favorite likely in there. But I took a look at number 9, Honduras. And this gelding has run well before his last start at Churchill Downs. He had run well in his two starts before that, finishing second. He was disqualified from that effort and posting a front-running win under Shanning Hill. Last two races has either caught serious pressure on the front end or been in too deep in those spots. Not a lot of pace in this field, I didn't think. And I think Honduras has a chance to get a dream trip on the front end. 15-1 on the morning line, one to consider for any multi-race tickets.
Nice, because I'm glad you hit that spot, because we didn't go over that, and I actually hadn't looked at it either. Who else, for those playing the pick 4, pick 5, who else is dangerous in there?
Well, like I said, I mean, those horses like Zipto, they're tough for me to figure. Like, it looks like just a fire sale in there. Even the number 11 was another one I thought was a little interesting. You have Summer Duck coming back in here, and he ran well this summer at Churchill Downs. I think that Fairmont Park race might throw people off running for $3,200 price, but it's a pretty competitive race, and I did like the race that Sazerac ran two starts back at Churchill Downs. He was claimed for that race. Didn't have the best trip, arguably, at Indiana Grand last time. So he's a contender in there for Michael Tomlinson.
Very good. All right. What else?
And then I'll mention in the feature, if it stays on the turf, it's the race number 10. It's a 1 mile turf allowance. Non-winners have won other than allowance. And it's a pretty well-matched race. Kadar is going to probably be the favorite for Mike Maker in there. I took a look at several horses in there, but I'm going to go with Midnight at Oasis off of maiden win. And Brian Lynch, he's having a fantastic meet. He's 4 for 15. He won a race yesterday. He's spotting serious seasoning in these horses, and there is some speed to the outside, but I don't think they're as quick as him, and I like the addition of Robbie Alvarado. One thing about Brian Lynch is he spreads his mounts around Mitchell Merle, James Graham, Declan Cannon, Leperoux, a whole bunch of jockeys have ridden his horses already this meet. He's putting up a good speed rider in Robbie Alvarado. Midnight Oasis X is a wire-to-wire sharp win at Kentucky Downs. The runner-up, Peter Miller, trainee, came back, won his next start. So I'm going to give him a shot, wire-to-wire, and Midnight Oasis, 8-1 on 41.
All right, nice.
And then I'll just mention the two graded stakes this weekend. I took a look at both races yesterday at work, and in the Native Diver at Del Mar, I like Leading Score. I think he's perfectly drawn on the inside. I don't think Despol, even though he's a front-running type, is all that quick and is going to sit second. And I look for him to bounce back. I mean, he's a five-year-old. He's only run nine times. But Baffert has him fit now. And, he's got a shot to put on a show, I think, on the front end.
Yeah, I didn't think it was slam dunk. And actually, Marty said that, I guess Baffert is running. He was considering the potential of coming to the Clark, but apparently right. He was leaning towards staying. So that seems a little open ended.
Brad Free though spoke to Baffert yesterday, according to his piece, and Baffert told him that he was staying
officially. Okay, good. All right, good job.
Yeah, I mean, that's not 100% because they could still change their minds. But yeah, Brad Free had it as he was running.
Nice. All right. Excellent.
And then the other race I'll mention real quick, Steve, is the Red Smith.
Yeah.
Heck of a betting race at Aqueduct tomorrow. Yeah. And, I'm intrigued by Nakamura. I like a horse that, like, with improving form like that. I think, this is his third state start, after running close fourth in that Japan Turf Cup and second in that Sycamore. I really like that allowance win at Saratoga in August. He beat a nice horse there at Midnight Tea Time, who was fourth last time in the Sycamore. And love those late pace ratings, 115, 105, 110 last three races. His four-year-old Son of Animal Kingdom definitely looks like he has a future. And I don't know if he can beat Sadler. I'm not 100% convinced he can beat Sadler's Joy, but I'm not sure that horse is going to show up with his best either. So Nakamura, it looks very interesting to me.
It's a competitive group, and there's a lot of ways to go. I agree. And at least including prices, probably advisable. James, I appreciate it. And we're off Wednesday, Thursday for Thanksgiving, but Friday we'll do a Clark show, a Clark preview, and we'll have the Stars of Tomorrow card to digest as well.
All right, fantastic. Look forward to it. Have a good Thanksgiving, Steve.
Happy Thanksgiving. James Scully, everybody. James_Scully111 on your Twitter. And, of course, on a regular basis, the Twin Spires blog roll. Let's take the bottom of the hour break. We're 90 in, 90 to come. Perfect timing. Brad Anderson's going to join us. We're going to talk about winning the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge. Once again, a circumstance where the leaderboard, the fur flew in the classic. We'll get the second-by-second report right from Brad and the decision-making that he had to engage in to punch it on Vino Rosso repeatedly. Back after this with your Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge winner, Brad Anderson.
Latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective time is saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through horsebiz.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the horsebiz.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebiz.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
DRF Sports Forum Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Forum delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsforum. Enter code DRF Sports.
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and kept the summer on Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Hey, you! Come on, here on the floor!
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Come out of here on the floor! Let's rock some more, yeah. Now when you get out here, don't you have no fear. Put your hands on your hip and let your backbone slip and work out.
We're back at the races. 25 minutes to the top of the hour. Always look forward to the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge victory conversation. We've already had a couple of other discussions, and of course the visit utilized the opportunity to talk to Dick Girardi as well, who finished third and flirted with a win, but it was Brad Anderson's all-in decisions on the Classic that made it happen, and comes away with the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge win. A pleasure to welcome Brad Anderson and to congratulate him on the BCBC win. Brad, well done.
Thank you, Steve. Good evening. And I need to comment that I always love your music. I think we're at about that same age, and I just love to hear your choices of music. So I'm assuming you have some say in that, but keep up the musical choices, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I do add all the, you know, all the music, and Casey and I have made it a kind of a point of the, you know, part of the show, and I've actually got a whole list of new additions. Plus, of course, we got a lot of favorites. The Christmas season cuts. They're they're closer than we'd like to believe, actually, because Thanksgiving right here and it's staring us in the face. So a lot of the favorites, including the all-time favorite, Christmas in Jail, that that's everybody's favorite. Brad, you know, talk a little bit about how this all came down for you. And, you know, we had the conversation with Dick the other day, and he was struggling, and he had to abandon, you know, some of his strategy. What were your thoughts going in, and how many of these have you participated in?
You know, I'm relatively new to contests. This is my second BCBC. I participated last year down in Churchill Downs, and just came away just loving that experience, loving the thrill of competing against the best and meeting some of these legends in the horse playing world, and really, you know, sat back and really tried to analyze how I performed there and really got me started then thinking about this year. And this year was a little bit different in that I did a little more research into how, you know, the winners had won in the past and really started to zero in on some key concepts that I wanted to execute during the tournament, you know, leading up to the Classic. Most of the past winners really made a significant bet in the Classic, and it catapulted them to the lead. So, you know, that was my strategy, is to understand how I could get into that latter part of the second day with a payroll that would allow me to not take a lot of risk. I wanted to be able to play a sensible bet as opposed to trying to, you know, pull in an exacta or a trifecta. I really wanted to zero in on a win bet to keep it as simple as I could and to reduce the risk. You know, in the Breeders' Cup, it's so hard to pick a winner in these races. The quality of horses is just fabulous. And I have a hard enough time zeroing in on a horse, trying to get a second horse or a third horse to come in, you know, for the exact effect. There was just a lot of additional risk. So, you know, the strategy was simple. Try to accumulate a bankroll that would allow me to, you know, take a confident shot somewhere along the 2 days, and then use that bankroll to go big in the Classic.
And that seems, you know, that seems to really mirror some of the things that Dick talked about on I guess that was Tuesday now, but the advantage that you seem to have had, that hit that you enjoyed early on the day Saturday, you went 0-for-3 on Friday with the, you know, with the minimums, and then started off strong when you leaned on Covfefe. And you know, this was one of the central themes of the discussions that we've had. I've also had Pete, and we've talked about it a couple of times already in the aftermath. You know, the decision about either utilizing horses like Covfefe and Bricks and Mortar, or either avoiding them or going up against them. What was your thinking on Covfefe? Because you really did get a nice little lick in there.
Yeah, you know, going into the tournament, Covfefe was my strongest opinion. I really, you know, was impressed with how she was running. And really, the rail didn't give me a concern, you know, with Rosario on board. You know, I just really, really thought Covfefe would run a great race. And so taking a favorite like that, I needed to get extra value in a way that would go back to, you know, give me a vault in the vault up on the bankroll. So then I did, you know, win bet on Covfefe, and then I did a couple of doubles into the next race, which was the Turf Sprint. And when I looked at the Turf Sprint, I thought it was a wide open race. I really didn't think there was a clear favorite that could win. So I did a couple of doubles, won a double in with all. And then I pressed, you know, four good price horses. You know, some of that was giving people that I respect that were positive on. And one of those horses, Belfort Bay, you know, ran a great race on a track she likes, and it turned Covfefe into a, you know, a 4-1 return as opposed to a 3-2. So it was an opportunity for me to take a horse that I really, really liked and get some additional value as opposed to the odds if I just singled her in a win bet.
You know, and again, to kind of parallel this to the discussion we had with Dick, kind of similar, he did the same thing with United, who he had expected, you know, would be kind of a back wheel horse, and takes bricks and mortar and parlays, you know, again, one of the weekend's most likely winners, if you believe that way, and turned it into, you know, a big hit that almost won the whole thing. And you did something similar here. And, it's interesting, Brad, because Dick was bemoaning the fact that by the time he got to the Dirt Mile, you know, relatively early on the Saturday card, he was not in the position he had hoped for because Spun to Run was one of his biggest opinions going into the weekend.
Yeah.
And that the difference really between where you end up and where Dick ends up is that you get this hit and it gives you the leeway later on. And he was on his heels. And when he had to make, a swing for the fences decision, it paid off as well. But it was kind of desperation time, simultaneously.
I have through this tournament been exposed to some horse players and both Dick and Bill Chavert, who finished second, have been more than just gracious. And, you know, for experienced horse players, for me to just to listen to them, how they think. And I thought your interview with Dick was just fabulous. And he's just such an enlightening individual. But when he made that bet, I mean, it threw off my strategy when it came in because, I mean, it was just a brilliant play on his part, but you're right. I think if he had a little more capital going into that, he would have been untouchable.
And that provides for you watching your plays after hitting the double, you basically played the minimum. You just were doing the requirements, and you kept it really straightforward and simple. And you know, you did take a couple of price shots here and there. For instance, it's kind of funny that you ended up on Sheki Shabazz as a win punch. I guess that's a cover in case the four horses you used in the double, none of them hit. You were betting Sheki, which was, I tell you what, he certainly ran well to be third.
He ran a great race, yeah. And that was, I mean, that's just an example of a minimum bet that you need to make in these tournaments that I thought would generate some extra cash and not being, exposed to a lot of additional risk. So, yeah, once that double came in for me, really the next, four or five bets were all just minimums. I knew now that I had a balance, that I could compete. And then, I landed on Spun to Run as well. And this was a horse as I did my research, just hearing some people that I just respect immensely, go to bat for this horse that others were questioning. And again, that was a minimum bet. I didn't bet a lot. But that then added some additional capital to me that really set me up for the strategy on the Classic.
Well, and what you did there was simply the $600 win bet, and you bring back $6,000.
Yep, yeah.
So let's see. Then we go to the 7th. You just a little double punch, Villa Marina. with Mattoli and Chance a lot. So that was a little bit of a swing, a fence swing, if Villa comes home.
Yeah, you know, and this is where, you know, a little bit of luck truly plays out. Because the other horse that I was going to pair with Mattoli and Chance a lot was Iridesa. You know, so after the race, I am just so mad at myself. I'm like, ah, this is one where I'm going to look back and just kick myself because I made the wrong choice. But it's ironic if I would have made that double, it probably would have given me enough capital to go into the Classic and be able to use the odds on McKenzie to go for the win. So, you know, that's one where I was mad when it happened, but now I just laugh and say, you know, some of that is just fate and luck, and it happened that, in essence, I made the right choice by losing that race.
Out of curiosity, in that spot, why not use both? Why not use Iridesa and Villa Marina with Mattoli and Chance a lot?
You know, great question. You know, again, it probably comes back to just trying to keep it simple and trying to, you know, I really in the sprint saw it as a speed duel with Mattoli and Chance a lot and wanted just to pick one horse in the Philly and their turf. But I think it's a great question and one in which I could look back on and say, you know, maybe in the future in those kind of situations, you should possibly explore adding, you know, a little complexity there.
Well, and it's almost like a dutching because Villa Marina was 14-1 and Iridesa was 13-1. So yeah. if you were splitting hairs about the price, then the other thing you could say to yourself is you could also narrow on the back end and make a commitment to one or the other, to Chance a lot or to Mattoli, and use both and only one horse on the back end. Strategically, it was not, you know, wasn't a bad idea. You had the right notion no matter how it turned out. You also come back and now we get to the mile, and here again, you had a clever concept. You bet without parole, and you're 600, and I wonder how many. I didn't go through every single ticket that all the postings of the players, but I wonder how much of the contest influenced how low without parole, you know, went off at 9-1.
Yeah, I think that's a great question and one in which it'd be interesting to do some additional analysis on that because, you know, what influence does it have on some of the pools that are out there?
Well, we know. I mean, it certainly, especially when we get to the Classic, historically that's been a big part of it. Without parole runs well, and you're just meantime you're still just treading water. Then you get to the Distaff, and in here you went ahead and embraced Midnight Bisou. Street Band was one of the exacta plays, and Blue Prize was the other, and you had to be thinking to yourself, why didn't I just do a $300 exacta box Blue Prize and Bisou?
Yep. Especially when that finished that way. I mean, that's where these exactas, you know, I'm still learning how to leverage it, but it can be so frustrating at times in terms of, you know, my handicapping brought it down to these two, and although both of them ran great races, it just ended up flip-flop, and I missed that. So, yeah, it's just, I think it illustrates a little bit of sometimes frustration of trying to get these exactas and trifectas right.
How much consideration did you give playing the turf? Did you come close at all, or at that point you strictly know that you're going to focus on your classic play?
Yeah, you know, at that point I had met the minimums, and it came down to you know, thinking I had enough capital. Now, at this point, going into the turf, a couple of things. One, I didn't know that Dick would make his brilliant bet on the exact. I hit it. So I was looking at, you know, my overall goal, it was around 100,000. That's what I was targeting to try to win the tournament. So it clearly influenced, you know, I wasn't going to bet on the turf. But I was fortunate that I had another entry that was still alive, Steve, and going into the turf, I had about 11,000 left on that entry. And, you know, the second most favorite horse that I liked was Bricks and Mortar. So on that entry, I did three doubles with Bricks and Mortar and then paired with Yoshida, War of Will, and Higher Power. So having that other entry sitting there, you know, allowed me to play the turf, and then with my winning entry, allowed me just to pass.
Well, then you're sitting with how much on the A ticket on the main play going into the Classic?
25,900.
25,900. And as you referenced a little bit ago, you came to Santa Anita expecting that McKinsey was going to be your play. And, you know, talk about what you're grappling with. You're obviously, I'm imagining that while the turf, you know, the lead up to the turf, you're looking at, you know, the probables for the doubles to, you know, to interpolate, you know, what the imputed odds are. Explain to everybody the mental gymnastics that go on during this hour.
Well, you know, since I was alive on my B ticket, you know, my first reaction when Bricks and Mortar won was just, I was extremely excited because now, in essence, I was going to have more than one chance in the Classic. And then, you know, the tournament standing that posted, and then, you know, here goes Dick just, you know, vaulting all the way to the top with a number that just, you know, put me in awe to say, oh my gosh. I mean, he hit that exacta, and it put me now in a position of having to make a really, really tough decision. And, you know, I think you get put into these situations and you find yourself going all over the place in terms of what do I want to do, you know, and one of the tenets was I wanted to win this tournament. I wasn't looking to walk away with payroll. I wasn't looking to walk away with a seat at the NHC. That just wasn't what I was trying to do here. So, you know, I went back to the strategy and my top two horses in the Classic were McKinsey and Vino Rosso. So to me, it wasn't, you know, all of a sudden I had to go to Vino Rosso. I liked Vino Rosso. I loved the Gold Cup. I loved the Jockey Gold Cup that he ran. You know, and I was familiar enough with, you know, his style to say, you know, this horse really has a shot. But it came down to then me looking at those two horses and the odds. And as you know, leading up to the Classic, there's a lot of time. And you're just sitting around just saying, really, do you really want to do this? Do you want to bet close to $26,000 on a single horse? So I went through the exactas. I went through, you know, what other bets could I do to possibly get to a number? And I was targeting 140, and I didn't know what Dick was going to do in the Classic. So you have to think, you know, he's at a number, but he could do something that gets him a little bit north of his number. So, you know, clearly I knew what the number was going to be. It was 140, and then I looked at, you know, what the odds were, and it came down to a fairly you know, single-threaded decision of, okay, what horse is going to win this race? And I landed on Vino Rosso, which then also would allow me, at least at that time, thinking that I had enough to win the tournament.
How much did you waver? And
I was surrounded by friends and you know, they were just a great sounding board and again, you never imagined that you'd be put in this position where, you know, I tried to treat this as just a tournament and the money was the money and my entry fees was just, you know, to pay to get the experience and to be around, you know, solid horse players and great people. And then you're faced with this decision, and the decision came down to, you know, the odds, and the odds made the decision for me. So then I, you know, went up and I put all of it on Vino Rosso and was just ready to sit back and try to just enjoy the moment and enjoy the experience.
The nice part about watching at that point, though, is that at no point it seemed to me, you know, especially at the end of the backstretch and as they moved toward the turn and into it, you could just see the way he was moving and, you know, basically bringing Arad to the lead. It just... he almost looked like a winner nearly every step.
Yeah, you know, looking back on how I experienced the race, I mean, to see him, you know, pass the grandstand the first time, and he was, you know, on the outside, I thought he looked just beautiful. He just looked like he was running and had a lot of energy. And then to see the race, you know, turn to the backstretch and, you know, see McKenzie start to challenge and, you know, then come around the far turn. And I knew in watching his races, it just feels like when he gets to that last stretch, he just finds a way to just get a gear and just to, you know, eat up a lot of dirt. And that's what he did. And it just, I mean, the race, I've watched it probably 25 times. And every time, it just is a remarkable feat of what, you know, Todd Pletcher did and how I ran. I mean, it was just, to me, it was perfect. Now, I'm a little biased because there's $145,000 being delivered to me when I got that bet correct. And then, you know, as the tournament played out, you realize that really you got paid, you know, close to, you know, $490,000 for that bet. It just makes it more special.
The trip out to Santa Anita for the Gold Cup, that when he went out there and won that for me, that's when I kind of filed that away personally, as, you know, as a horse that is going to be reckoned with, you know, down the road. I mean, knowing that, I mean, the track was obviously even heavier by the time we got to November than it was in the spring. But that part of it for me was always in the back of my mind. Talk a little bit too, as part of the overall approach, what you use. What are your handicapping toolbox favorites, and, you know, talk a little bit about how your game in general has evolved.
Well, you know, I still consider myself a novice, and I've got a lot to learn when it comes to handicapping. But I start with the daily racing forums, the PPs, and I'll make my notes around the horses and who I like and why. You know, with a focus on the horse's form, the history. You know, so I'll watch key races. I'll try to get some insight on the workouts and some of those reports. And then, you know, then I get as much data from experts that I respect, either through podcasts, columns, and friends. And I love accumulating a variety of data points. You know, in my business career, I would always surround myself with the smartest people I could find
and then leverage their opinions to make decisions. And that's how I treat my handicap. I mean, I look for people that I respect who, you know, have a lot more knowledge or expertise, use my opinion as the foundation, and then adjust. You know, I'm primarily a win bet guy. I do like exactas and trifectas at times, but I still feel like I've got a lot to learn. And then the multi-race bets is something that I want to expand in terms of how I bet. But yeah, so it really is, you know, try to come up with my own opinion, then listen to the experts, and then go forward. And again, I don't really play a lot of contests. So my first contest was in the summer of 17 in Arlington Park, and I won an entry into the NHC. So I was out in Vegas for the NHC and participated in that. And then, you know, last year was my first BCBC. And as I said, I you know, the experience to me was just one in which I just had a great time. I mean, I walked away, you know, zero money. But it was the experience. It was meeting some of these handicappers who are just generally good people once you get to meet them and shake their hand. So it, you know, it's an evolving handicapping style, but it's one in which I think I lean on just get an opinion, get a lot of data, and then, you know, zero in on how you need to adjust your opinion if you think you do.
You mentioned Arlington. You're from Chicago. You're from Chicago proper or suburbs?
You know, I was born and raised in the Midwest, so Iowa, and then my career brought me to Chicago. I spent a little bit of time in Atlanta, but majority of my career is Chicago land, so in the suburbs. And so that's where I would, you know, start to enjoy the racing more. You know, as all of us, we get a career, we get a family, and I kind of put this on the back burner and kind of viewed it as a hobby, but was something that, you know, was down the road. And as my kids got older and my career was more formulated, then I was able to start spending a little bit more time at Arlington Park and really enjoyed, again, getting back to that.
I love it. Where in Iowa did you grow up?
You know, a small farming community called Roland. It is just north of Ames, so almost in the center of the state.
Nice. Did you go to I-State?
You know, my older brother and my twin sister both went to Iowa State, and I was the rebel. I couldn't follow in their footsteps.
So, is it your Hawkeye?
I have a lot of family, grandparents, aunts and uncles that grew up in the Ames area. So it's a great place, and I love going back there. But it wasn't where I got my education.
That's funny, because when I was in Kansas City, I called on Ames. I had sales, you know, business for Proctor there, and it's just wonderful. And Des Moines as well. I mean, my forays over the border from Missouri were always pleasant. I got there about maybe twice a year for, you know, for about 2 years, but I always enjoyed going up and. And in particular, and became a bit of a clone fan too at the time. I mean, going forward, it's a really cool place. Where was your first racetrack experience? Did you Nebraska or?
No, you know, I kind of remember. I think my grandfather took me to the Quad Cities to see some Greyhound racing.
Nice.
So
nice.
You know, my first experience was at Arlington, and now. You know, I'm trying to get to all the tracks. This is my first trip to Santa Anita. So I've still got a lot of other tracks that I need to visit. But Arlington Park will always be my home. And it's such a beautiful facility.
And anybody
who gets there, it's just a great way to go spend an afternoon with friends and enjoy the horse racing and the camaraderie.
The NHC seat that comes with this too. How do you? I suppose you, given your approach, the win place concept of NHC probably fits your approach. You could be just as dangerous there.
Yeah, Yeah, you know, I participated back in 17, and it was just an overwhelming experience.
Yes,
I mean, it's
first
just,
time.
You know, there's just so many people, and it's all about fun and long-term friendships you can see that have been established, and starting to get integrated into that is fun. You know, the format is one in which, I do like it. It's a little bit of a challenge because there's so many races. You know, with the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, it's focused on those races at the track, and you can really zero in and do your handicapping. In that tournament, it's much broader. So it's going to test a lot of my skills of being able to, you know, very quickly do some assessing of these races and the horses I like. And, you know, it's ironic, this summer at Arlington Park, I was able to meet Scott Coles, who's also Chicago area.
That's right.
Horse player who won the NHC last year. So, you know, jokingly, I haven't talked to Scott, but I think I'm going to be leveraging a little bit of his experience to try to make sure I can execute my strategy in a way in which can make me competitive.
Well, just with this kind of a performance and this kind of a win, what do you expect it just does for confidence too? I mean, in general.
Yeah, it does give you a little confidence when you can execute a strategy as well as your handicapping expertise. I mean, it gives me a lot of confidence, but you know, at the same time, I think back to, you know, when you enter these tournaments, the twists and turns in these tournaments are not a result of strategy or planning. And I think it takes your skill to adjust your strategies as those twists and turns occur. So, I mean, you know, go back to some of the bets that I didn't make. Go back to the way that Dick executed his bet. I mean, your strategy is there, and then you have to adjust on the fly. So I think that's where, to me, these tournaments are so thrilling in terms of you have to be thinking on your feet. And to me, that's where a plan is a plan, and you need to stick to that plan. And fortunately, that's what I was able to do, but there was luck in there as well. I mean, there's no denying that luck plays a lot of the success. But, you know, I'm also, you know, a firm believer that you make your own luck. You've got to be in a position to have the data in front of you to make these changes as luck appears or doesn't appear.
Well, always an appropriate time to pull out Branch Rickey. luck is the residue of design. That's one of the great quotes there ever.
Yeah, I pair that one with the Hemingway one about you make your own luck. I just think, you know, to me, you got to get grounded and there is luck and you have to embrace it and don't get frustrated when you don't have it, but embrace it when it does land in your lap.
Well, and you also are touching on one of the things that Dick brought up too, which is, you know, not being intimidated or not being overwhelmed or not getting mad at yourself and letting that creep into your decision making, not getting looking at the leaderboard and thinking, ugh, I have to completely abandon my strategy. There's so many taxing elements when it comes to, you know, the people's personalities in this game.
Yeah.
And I haven't talked about this lately much, but this is always a good occasion. You know, big wins that result in, you know, multi-hundred-thousand-dollar profits. More or less, you know, tackling any inner demons or inner dialogues that hold you back. That's as much a challenge around this endeavor when in horseplay as anything that goes into the handicapping part.
Yeah, funny you mention that, Pete, because you know, as being a relatively new player in these contests, you know, some of these individuals you're competing against, they're just larger than life in my mind. And some of that is their bold personality, their deep expertise and knowledge, and can, you know, recite facts that just amaze me in terms of how they retain it. And then when you get into these contests and you see your name next to them, it's like, you know, you just have to shake your head and say, okay, you're here. You know, your plays have gotten you to be competing against the best of the best. Just continue to execute the plan and you know, enjoy the experience. And that clearly in you a little bit. I am not going to, you know, play a lot of tournaments. I have other interests. I got a big family that I like to spend time with, and my wife and I just moved to Sarasota, Florida, and I'm retired, and it's going to be one of many interests and hobbies that I have in playing these tournaments.
Well, and Tampa, you've been to Tampa Bay, obviously, if you do the West Coast.
You know, and nice. I mentioned Bill Shavert, who finished second. He lives in Central Florida and spent some time down in Gulfstream. So he was gracious enough to invite me down there as well. So, yeah, I think, you know, being here in Florida, there's a lot of opportunity to continue the journey of my handicapping and horse playing.
Well, Brad Anderson, just an absolute pleasure, and these are always one of my, you know, some of my favorite visits and discussions. You know, hearing how things unfolded and being able to, you know, to encourage others to participate, and certainly there's been a nice parade of you know, relative newcomers to the contest scene. You mentioned Scott and Matt Valvolgi, of course, came out of NHC yep. last year, and we're not far, you know, from heading to Vegas, probably about 90 days away. Well done, Brad, and I so appreciate you taking the time to visit.
Well, Steve, thanks for the invite. You know, when I look at your roster of guests today, it just amazes me. It kind of just puts it in perspective when you look at some of the expertise and the individuals you have. And so it's a pleasure, and I hear happy belated birthday is on order, and please have a safe and enjoyable Thanksgiving with friends and family.
Awfully kind, and same to you and yours. Brad Anderson, everybody. And Brad is also a relative newcomer, it seems, to Twitter. And I guess you're wading into the action.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a big social media guy, but, you know, I do like to kind of browse Twitter a lot. I'm not an active poster, but... you know, I think I'll probably keep that pattern until I get a little more bolder on some of my statements in the Twitter land. It is a different experience in terms of social media.
Well, you've kept it very simple and humble with just the Vino Rosso stretch run at the top of your page, and you probably should pin that. You could probably use the pinning feature and keep that up at the top of the page, and you can follow Brad follow him and congratulate him. Anderson Brad A. Anderson Brad A. And this is an Anderson with an O.
My parents make sure that I always say it's an O and not a U. You know the difference between the Norwegians and the Swedes.
Well, and it's funny because we're going to follow you with an E, with Brad Anderson from the Daily Racing Form, and there's exactly the distinction. Educate everybody on which is which, the O and the E. Who gets which?
Well, I mean, to me, it was always you know, the Hans Christian Andersen, and you know, the E's traditionally are more from Sweden, and the O's are traditionally from Norway. So, and it's always that they're friendly neighbors, but there's always been ripping passions. Those alliances and allegiances.
I love it. Well, Brad Anderson, Congratulations again. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
How much fun was that? Brad Anderson joining us, and we're going to stay right here because standing by is Steve Anderson. And important to get Steve on this morning, given yesterday's CHRB meeting, and also a fairly notable performance on the chase scene, going back to last weekend that I can use with Steve's visit, because at Punchestown there was Faheen last week at the age of 12, Steve, and I'm sure you've seen him several times over the years. Unbelievable that Willie Mullins would be so audacious and bring him back as a chase.